Thank you, Maggie. Thank you for joining us, everybody. Thank you, Walter, for taking this time with John and I and the rest. So we, you know, it's always exciting to talk to you. So thank you for being here.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
So as a frame for this conversation, we've chosen to focus on the question of poverty, the question of the poor, the question of income disparities. This is a part of a national and world conversation now. And our goal is to just try to shift our understanding about that. Is there a different way to think about income equality, inequality? Why, after all these years and wars on poverty, do we see the poor growing, the middle class shrinking? And is there something we in our lives and our thinking and our language can do to kind of welcome the poor in from exile, treat them as neighbors, as citizens, and instead of as labeled people? So that's kind of where we're headed. And maybe, John, you could get us started with some thoughts that you and Walter were talking about before we began.
Well, Walter wrote a paper in which he was trying to, among other things, from the Old Testament, the location of people who were the elites. And in a couple of places, the paper, he says the elites are urban elites. So, Walter, I was wondering, the people that who are the powerless people are the rural people, the peasants, and the people who have power are the elites in cities. Cities. What is it about cities that seem to produce the people who have the power that the rest of the society, I think that's very even today.
Well, in my discipline now, it's very fashionable to talk about urban elites as the people who managed things in ancient Israel from Jerusalem, and they were clustered around the temple and around the monarchy, and they had increasingly a disproportionate part of the wealth, and they had reduced the peasants to menial standard of living, and they siphoned off all the surplus to enhance well-being in the city. That's a kind of a simple analysis, but it has good economic grounding behind it. And if one thinks that way, then it's a pretty easy transfer to talk about the urban elites in our society who now control the media, they control the banking system, they largely control the government. So that the new rules all cause money to be transferred from the common population to those who are blessed by the elites and their supporters and their donors. So I think that the situation is roughly analogous, and what people in Old Testament study are saying is that it's rather extraordinary that the Old Testament manages to continue the voice of the peasant class that is largely squeezed out by the urban elites. They still have their say. And I suppose that it's fair to say that the crisis in our society now is whether, by analogy, whether that peasant layer of the economy can still make its voice heard as the urban elites increasingly control access to media and to public expression. So I think that the parallel works simplistically, but very well.
Yeah. Is there, in the paper I read, you're quoting often the prophets. And they're commenting on this locus of power. What do they say you should do about it?
Well, I think the prophets are, by and large, allied. They claim to be speakers for God, who they say is allied with the peasant class over against the urban monopoly. And on the one hand, they warn the urban monopoly that if they don't change their ways and fund the neighborhood, it's all going to come crashing down on them. And I think that the very act of this poetic poetry itself is designed to authorize and empower the peasant community that heard these poems so that they come to a new awareness of their entitlement and their capacity to take some initiative. So I believe that the prophets want to evoke in the peasant class a new imagination about social possibility that they probably had mostly forfeited in their loss of power and wealth and leverage. So I think the recovery of that kind of imagination was a primary aim of these poets.
If you thought about that in terms of the parallelism mentioned earlier, where do we hear those voices today? Who are they?
Well, I think they come in many forms of subversive music now, and I think that in many cultures outside of the dominant West, there are poets and poetic figures who utter these subversive things. I suppose the most visible of these subversive poets in recent time probably has been Desmond Tutu, who really stood outside, even though he had a bishop's office. He really employed a different kind of rhetoric that I think energized people. And I think we have some of those poetic voices among us, but they very quickly get silenced or they get co-opted, and it's hard to sustain that in a monopolized society like ours.
So control of the media makes the voice of the prophet very silent.
That's exactly right. And you can already see in the Old Testament that the urban elites of king and priest and scribe did everything they could to silence these voices that were very dangerous to them and very unwelcome to them. So you can see with Amos and with Jeremiah and some of the others that they really had to kind of hide out for their lives. The amazing thing is that they have such resilience that they just keep coming back at it. It's kind of interesting, the big obituary of Nadine Gordimer in South Africa. She was a novelist, and she very much was on the outside. The New York Times obituary of her life tells her how she just kept coming back to it and wouldn't leave the apartheid issue alone, even though the government did everything it could to kind of marginalize her or exclude her. And I think that's a kind of an analog to
right.
What we have. Yep.
Peter.
Well, you know, it seems that the commons movement is a kind of a rural land environment that is a prophetic voice. You see increasingly people, you know, websites and commons about reclaiming the commons. Privatization, to me, is the modern version of stealing the land and the cows and economic apartheid that we're going into, which started in the 17th century. And what's interesting to me, though, is most of the commons conversation is about the environment and the land and the wind and the water. And it hasn't joined with poverty. It hasn't joined with the voices about economic apartheid or econocide is what somebody calls it in Cincinnati.
That's right. So and until it's joined with the economy, it stays kind of romantic. It's easy to talk about wind and water if you don't connect it to economic issues. That's exactly right. Yep.
And so it says to me that we've exiled the poor. And I think especially in the West and in the United States, we think it's their fault. Were the poor in exile in the Old Testament, Walter? Were they the widows and the immigrants and orphans? Were they in exile also?
They weren't deported in the big exile, but they were certainly exiled in the internal economy of Israel, which of course is why the prophets. It's almost like a mantra of that triad: of widows and orphans and immigrants. These were the people who did not have social standing. They didn't have legal leverage. They didn't have economic advocates, and so they had to settle for the crumbs that fell out of the dominant economy. And that's a kind of a different connotation for the word exile. But they no doubt were outsiders. And one of the ways the text then handles that is to declare them ritually unclean. So that means they didn't have access to high liturgy worship and all of that. And I think we declare people ritually unclean in our society in terms of access to good education or to good medical care. We just categorize people who are not eligible for that, which is a form of exile and powerlessness.
And when we talk about universal medical care or other kinds of things, we say it's an assault on capitalism. And,
well, it is an assault on a certain kind of capitalism. That assumes that it's a privatized rat race to monopoly. But it is, of course, possible to conceive capitalism in a neighborly way in which the people who are making all the money have a greater responsibility to the common good. And there have been those practices of capitalism. So it isn't a wholesale condemnation of capitalism. It is a critique of the way in which capitalism has morphed in our society into privatized monopoly. And I think there are parallels to that in the Old Testament. Pharaoh is obviously in the Exodus story is the big monopolizer, but inside Israel, Solomon is the prototype of the monopolizer who did not care about the common good. And those are the, so to speak, those are the capitalists that draw the rhetoric of the prophets.
Do the texts tell us about some people of influence or power who were sharing, who were on a positive side of capitalism?
They don't explicitly say that, but they do talk about power people who were allied with the prophets, so that one can imagine, for example, that Jeremiah was not a lone voice, but he really was the point person for a very significant political opinion that opposed the monopoly. And he had some very high-powered allies who sat in the king's cabinet. So there's not a great deal of evidence for that, but there is evidence for it, so that there were people who were inside the community of the urban elite who knew better than that, and who spent some energy and took some risk to try to break that open. So I think it's not all work from the outside. But there is also evidence of some insiders who know that something has to change.
Do you think the new pope might be a prophetic voice in that direction?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Do you think the new pope might be
I think indeed he is. That's right. And, of course, that's why some on the right have condemned him and do not understand that he is a faithful voice of the social teaching of the church, because the Catholic Church and all of the responsible churches have long had teaching about the economic common good that has been so skewed in recent time by this new capitalism. So I think Francis is a really important voice about that. Yes.
Walter, if the texts that I see you quoting from the prophets especially are so much focused on the value and the dilemma that people who don't have power and money experience, it's sort of curious to me is it's pretty clear that prophets are not there speaking in behalf of the people at the top. And so if I were a person who had some desire to express the Old or the New Testament, but I was a part of the people who hold the power, and it seems to me a lot of people who hold power purport to be agents of faith.
Yep.
How do you deal with that dilemma?
How do you what?
Deal with that dilemma. I mean,
most parts of the church deal with that dilemma in very cowardly ways. The primary strategy that we use is lectionary, which is a screening out of all of the unhappy texts. but I think inside the church community, we have in as sensitive a way as we can. We have to make the case that the dominant tradition of faith invites to an alternative and mounts a sustained critique against an economy of monopolized privatism. Unless we're going to abandon the tradition completely, that is simply what the main conversation needs to be about in the church in the affluent West. The purpose of that conversation is not to upset people. The purpose of that conversation is to help people see that most of us are very double-minded. We are double-minded in that we really greatly benefit from the new capitalism, many of us, and at the same time, we are deeply committed to these old traditions. And until that double-mindedness is made explicit and named, then people do not have the chance to sort it out and to make fresh decisions. So what we do is we hide it or we mumble about it so that our own double-mindedness is kept hidden from us. And when it is kept hidden from us, we cannot sort it out and we cannot make new decisions. So I think that honesty is really a primary ingredient of now what has to happen in communities of faith in our society.
Well, I think, don't we have a long tradition of dealing with that paradox, and it's called charity.
It's called, yes, but of course charity.
And isn't that what we need is charity?
That's the easy solution, isn't it? What we need is neighborly justice, and most of the church's practice of charity is sort of a kind of an innocuous generosity that doesn't expose any of the real systemic problems. So charity is really an act of concealment, and of course, all Americans and all American Christians are very eager to be charitable as long as no questions are raised about the system. But of course, the prophetic tradition keeps raising those underneath questions. So when they talk about care for the widow, the orphan, and the immigrant, they didn't just mean handouts. They meant provisions to which these members of the community are entitled by force of law. So it really has to come to a policy conversation and not simply isolated, well-meaning acts of generosity.
No.
So when I think about charities, charitable activities, I should also be asking, is this a substitute for justice?
Well, we intend it to be a substitute for justice. We ease our conscience, and then we think we don't have to think about this anymore. We don't have any more work to do. But I think it was Ivana Huffington who famously said that you can easily raise money for a symphony or an opera, but if you want to feed hungry children, her phrase was, you need the raw power of government. And so she's talking about justice being a serious institutional social commitment. And what we know from the whole history of the West is that if religious institutions do not raise these questions, they are likely not to be raised much, particularly if the labor movement is completely nullified. That's been the other really major voice about raising these questions, and you can see the enormous efforts to domesticate the labor movement so that it has no force.
You know, it seems that the assault in the last 30 years against government is almost designed to reduce its capacity to care for the widows and immigrants and orphans. But there is in the Bible the Jubilee idea, which is forgiving the debts of the poor every 7 years or 49 years. And what strikes me is that internationally there has been, in 2000, there was a very powerful Jubilee movement of international debt forgiveness and billions of dollars of poor countries. I've never seen much about the idea of doing it in my neighborhood, you know, in my city. Could you talk a little bit, Walter, about the Jubilee idea and the forgiveness of debts?
Well, you're right. The provision of the Jubilee year was designed in ancient Israel to keep from developing a permanent underclass, so that the provision was to restore a viable amount of property and resources to those who had lost it in the rough and tumble. Now, some listener is going to probably raise the question about, did they ever really implement the Jubilee year? And my answer to that is, they imagined it. They imagined that it belonged properly to a neighborly economy. And I think it is so hard to think about something like the cancellation of debts in our society, because so many people in the new capitalism are scared to death that some poor person is going to get something free for nothing. And so the Jubilee year is an unconditional restoration of property and resources to people that capitalism, the new capitalism, might well call the undeserving. So it is really a radical alternative economic provision. But what they apparently understood in the Old Testament that got carried in many ways into the New Testament was that you cannot have a viable neighborhood unless economic procedures are subordinated to the common good. And what the new capitalism, probably led by Margaret Thatcher, the new capitalism wants to pretend that the economy has no obligation to the common good. And that's about where we are in our society. So the articulation of the Jubilee year is a reminder to us that the economy is not an autonomous operation, but it is a way in which the neighborhood administers its resources. And so the recovery of the Jubilee in local or in more broadly public ways, I think, is really an urgent matter. What a difference it would make if we mobilized our resources that are well available simply to forgive student debts. that would be a renewal and a restoration of our society. But of course, that means some student would get something for nothing. That's what we have to think about.
We did that with the GI Bill after the Second World War with free education. The other thing, you talk about new capitalism, you know, we have the notion that some places are too big to fail. And I was thinking maybe we need too small to fail would be an alternative act of imagination. Because right now it's like if you're small, it's your fault, and so we let you fail.
Yep.
Peter, you raise really a good example when you think about the veterans who came back, because you can look at policies in terms of how we dealt with these people called veterans, because they weren't veterans. They were our sons and our fathers and our husbands. And what did we do? What we did was we said, we are going to put you in a situation in terms of education where the government is going to use its wealth for your education. And to get you in decent, we're going to insure the housing so bankers' money will flow through the VA and FHA loans so you can buy a house for almost anything. And if you really are damaged physically by the war, we have the responsibility for a whole healthcare system, which then was pretty good administration. So the really impressive thing is that if you look at what we did for ourselves, we turned to the state in critical areas. And now we have all kinds of saying, no, we shouldn't do that. And I think they use the poor as getting something free as an excuse for not doing it. So the poor are used to justify practices that don't recognize the common good.
There's one we're going to, I think we should stop in a second and see if there are questions or comments. One more thing I'd love you, John, and Walter to reflect on. And I've been thinking that even calling people poor, you know, we've changed the language for other people on the margin, the disabled, the people recovered from mental illness, but we still stigmatize people. And I think part of the reason we keep them marginalized is because calling somebody poor, working poor. Have all this language born of the charity mindset, I think. You know, a single-parent household. That somehow we need another language, another way of speaking to people who are defined by more than their economic status. Because we think that because you're poor or your income level is below $25,000, that's who you are. And so part of the, and then the poor begin to believe that, like you said, Walter, the Jews needed an act of new imagination in order to imagine. So any thoughts each you have about this, what I'm talking about, is if it's not as vague to you as it is to me?
Well, I think earlier you had suggested, as we were talking before we got on the call, Peter, that the word neighbor is a very good word. What that suggests is that poor people and people who are not poor have in common that we all belong to the same neighborhood. And what we know is that the neighborhood, if the neighborhood doesn't flourish, none of us is finally safe. So I think maybe with some modifier about a neighbor without adequate resources or something like that, but neighbor would be powerfully redefining of the whole economic transaction.
Thank you. You know, in the crime world, they have something they call even a show called Person of Interest.
Yes.
Maybe we should call them Neighbors of Interest.
That's right. That's right. That would be good. Right. Good.
John, any thoughts? And then I think we should ask Maggie to see if there's people that want to.
Yeah, I think we're the listeners in here.
Okay. Maggie, can you do that?
Sure. For those of you who have dialed in and would like to join the conversation, you can hit *8 on your phone and you'll be put into a queue and I can unmute you at that time. We also have a couple of comments in the couple of questions and comments in the chat box. Peter, are you seeing the chat box?
No, I can't. Can you help us with that, Maggie?
Sure, sure. So here's one question. Class is inextricably intertwined with race. Your thoughts about the role of faith institutions in achieving racial and economic justice today?
Walter.
Well, I think we work at it, but we're very slow. And I agree that race and class are all tangled together. I happen to think that class is a more decisive category than race, but that doesn't mean that race is unimportant, and it's a huge hill we have to climb about that. Just the whole business about the new Jim Crow and all of that is a measure of the resistance and the anxiety in our society about coming to terms with racial justice.
You know, I think if race, which usually means African American, wasn't so much economic disparity, we would call it an issue of ethnicity. It's just the fact that there's such an economic crisis in the black economy. You know, Jim Clingman writes a book called Blackonomics and said that when blacks got their political freedom, the Civil Rights Act, they lost their economic freedom because they started then the neighborhood economy, black economy, was dissipated. So I think even the race conversation, more like you said, Walter, is more about class and economics.
Yep.
Than,
Maggie, and that, sure. I just wanted to point out that the person who had asked that question while you guys were talking posted a comment that just says, thank you for pointing out the implications of a weaker labor movement and our efforts to reduce inequality. And there is one other question in the chat window. How do you recommend that we nurture autonomy and responsibility and interdependence as a people, a community?
I think that's the
most significant question that I know for the future of the United States and a lot of Western countries and democracy. That we have lost in two generations our understanding of our mutual opportunity and responsibility to care for each other. And there's a reciprocity in all of that. My mother we lived in a working class, I'd say a lower income working class neighborhood in Cincinnati when I was a kid in the Depression. And the man next door lost his job. And my mother went next door and talked to the family and said, until you get your job back, I know how hard this is, we'll prepare your meals. Now, we could do that because my father had a job. It was pretty low paying, but at least we had some income. And so for 3 years, she prepared dinner for 9 people, 4 people next door and 5 people in our family. And when I got older, maybe I was 30, I asked her, I said, Mom, why did you prepare the meals for the Thawls for that long time, 3 years? And she said to me, as though it was curious that I would even ask the question, she said, well, John, they were my neighbors. And she said, you know, lots of people, it was actually over 33% at that time, were out of work. What would they do if I didn't feed them their meals? but they would have done the same for. And that's how Americans who were, quote, unemployed survived in the first half of the 30s when there was no Social Security, no unemployment compensation, hardly any New Deal programs that had gotten down. So the curious, speaking to the writer's question, is that in only generations, in most neighborhoods, we have lost the meaning of the word neighbor and replaced it with consumer. How many neighbors and neighborhoods, when somebody's house got the foreclosure, got together and said, what can we do? We don't want to lose these people. They're our neighbors. In the 30s, we would have had a house party, and the musicians would come, and we'd raise at least the money for the rent. So the curious thing is that in only two generations, we have by and large lost that sense of the common good, mutual connection to it. So
you know,
I think the new way of thinking about possibility is, how do we recreate a culture, mutual responsibility to replace the consumerism that has become the blight on our land?
You know, during that period, it gave rise, though, to government action, Social Security, income tax.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and so, but today, it's the rise of a libertarian viewpoint. And so in some ways, to say, well, your neighbor should take care of the person next door becomes the business case for the Tea Party mentality, a libertarian mentality. And charity. So I think that what's lost is the commons. And what we've forgotten is the governments is the one institution who has the assignment to take care of the common good.
Yeah.
And somehow we have to kind of re-embrace government. But
I think that the government can't care. Mother could express care and her neighbor could express care to each other. What the government can do, I don't think we want government in the charity business.
Well,
what the government can do is get policy income disparity. That land issue where government really has the tools to change things.
What do you think, Walter, about this question of shared accountability? What's going through your mind at the moment?
Well, I think it's, as John was talking then when you're talking, I think it's a both and. I think we do need generosity in our neighborhoods face-to-face. But if that isn't the context of neighborly policy, then it's like a drop in the bucket. So we need both advocacy at a policy level to recover the proper functions of government. And we've been shaving those off since Ronald Reagan. I think we ought to name libertarianism for what it is. It's simply a strategy to keep from sharing in the common good. And that makes society unsustainable. No society can live without neighborliness in the long run.
It's political individualism.
So, excuse me, guys, but we have three callers and a couple of more questions.
Good.
Thank you, Maggie, for saving us.
Yeah, right.
So I'd like to go ahead and include the first caller, who is from East Virginia. So, okay, are you on the call now?
Yes, Peter, Walter, Don?
Yes.
Yes, great. This is Dave Cooper calling. Really appreciate the conversation today. A couple of things I wanted to touch on, get your response to. I heard Walter say there needs to be a serious institutional commitment to the policy conversation. just in the past few minutes, some conversation about the necessity of engaging in advocacy for the common good, and that the government can be a mediator or a policy setter that could provide some of the infrastructure to accomplish that. I've personally worked with community organizing groups. A friend of mine, Robert C. Linthicum, out in California, has worked on building people of power. And as you're well aware, there are just a number of groups across the country that have worked on lobbying efforts, developing million-person marches. And yet, there persists this level of power, entrenched power, in our Congress that just seems to be resistant to the efforts of common folks and even the institutional voice. And I'm wondering what strategies you might have in mind to overcome some of those challenges.
Well, I think we need every strategy we can think of. My natural habitat is the church, and I don't think that the church is terribly special or anything, but it's my community. And I think that were the church to be concerned for the generation of political will, the church has, even in its relative demise, it has more access to more people who say they care about these things than almost anybody else. And I think it requires some courage in the church, some honesty, to recruit and mobilize people to act out of their faith toward the public good. And I think our cowardly abdication about that in the church needs to be called into question and needs to be reversed. I don't think that's an all-purpose solution, but I think that is one thing that really ought to be very important to us. The institutional church counts for a great deal, and this stuff about neighborly justice is in our DNA, and it needs to be performed, along with all the other allies that can be mobilized.
And as you mentioned earlier, Walter, I think the church is even more because of the decline in membership in the unions. So the voice of the church is more than ever before.
Well, let me interrupt, Maggie. We've got two more callers. I'd like to hear you invite them in. Maggie?
Sorry. now we're going to invite Washington, D.C., I think. Okay, do we have Washington, D.C. on the line?
Yes, it is. Hello?
Hello?
This is Bob Whitson, John.
Hey, Bob. How you doing?
Just fine. I just have a question and a comment. Throughout the whole discussion, you seem to be generalizing about the have-nots as if they were an indistinguishable category of people, totally at the mercy of forces beyond their control, and sort of demonizing the, quote, haves as being uncaring. And and my concern is, and that government, therefore, is the deliverer of the have-nots. But in the black community, when even during the 10 years of the Depression between 1930 and 1940, we had a higher marriage rate than when the black community. We didn't have grandparents afraid of their children. We maintained strong families up until 1962, where 85% of all black families had a man and a woman raising children. And we also, our own charitable institutions, placed demands on people as a condition of them receiving help. And yet all of these standards, we fell off a cliff in 1962 at the time of the war and poverty, to the point where there's been, in the last 50 years, a degeneration of that. So somehow I don't see how that reality comports with some of the things you're saying.
How do you make sense of that, Bob? This is Peter.
What'd you say?
How do you make sense of that degeneration, that what's happened?
I think that what happened is, as from what I lived a part of that in New York and Los Angeles and other places, where I think policymakers with good intentions, after the Watts riots, assumed that black families, that it was racist to expect them to conform to the same moral standards and judgments about family. We stopped distinguishing between the poor and the undeserving poor. Civil rights policy got joined with social policy. I mean, we said that privacy rights are being violated to ask a woman about the paternity of a child. And then we talked about menial work. Blacks were discouraged from the garment industries. And so welfare soared precisely at a time when unemployment among blacks were 4% in New York. So one cannot say that that explosion in on welfare was associated with downturns in the economy. It was just the opposite. And I think it was a part of a lot of social planners who believe that. So anyway, I could go on. But anyway, I just think that there's another side to that I'm not hearing in this discussion.
Thank you very much.
Bob's a really important voice, the points that he's making. I want to ally myself with his points by the distinction I was trying to make, which was to say he's talking about a set of community compacts of neighborliness that were real and had consequence in the lives of people. And we can't reconstruct that or have that happen again, I think, by programs that are going to intervene in people's lives. I do think, Bob, I don't know what you think about this, but I do think that focusing on the income disparity, that dealing with the way jobs get available and the income disparity gets closed, that's really something I believe in government. But I
John,
think you're making
John,
a good point.
The disintegration of communities that I'm working in around the country have nothing to do with its economy. We have a 9/11 every 6 months of blacks killing blacks. That has nothing to do with people out of work who are blowing their brains out. That's a cultural crisis, and therefore it has to be addressed internal to that community. That's a crisis in values, and just saying, in fact, to say that somehow that those kind of crises that's paralyzing those communities can be solved with some economic remedy. I don't see it, John. Where you go to Chicago, tell me how income inequality or income, any way of redistributing income is going to address that problem.
No, see, I just have a little party on that. I think it is a cultural problem now, but I still think access to the economy is the most likely way to begin to shift that kind of cultural problem.
I think the question is the means, and the, you know, there's a whole local movement everywhere, and what will shift the economy, and I think that's why, Walter, your voice is so important, because you're talking about it in a very powerful, asking for a different kind of imagination, different kind of entitlement initiative, I think. So now we've got one more caller. Do we still have one, Maggie? I want to give everybody a chance to. Thank you very much, Bob, but let's see who's next.
Okay, yes. We've got one from New York.
This is Joyce McKnight.
Hello, Joyce.
Hi, this is Joyce McKnight, no relation to John, but a great admirer, professor of community organizing at the State University of New York, with students all over the state, mostly in poor communities. And I beg to differ with a number of statements and agree with a number of statements. First of all, I don't think that the problem is economic. I think the problem is cultural and economic. One of the things that President Obama said in one of his two favorite famous speeches, I'm not sure if it was the one on religion or the one on race, but he said that there were two issues. There's an economic issue, and there's the issue of the hole in people's souls. And I think that the hole in people's souls has to do with, I would say, with the Christian tradition, but I would also say it has, and with Jesus particularly. And I would also say, though, that the neighborliness, John, that you mentioned back in your neighborhood in the 30s, I happen to have been privileged to live in poor, mostly black and mixed racial communities in the inner city and also now in the Adirondacks of New York. And I would say that that neighborliness among the poor of people helping people still exists, still is miraculous, happens right in the neighborhood, right across the street from me. And I would just disagree that that's gone. I think that maybe it's gone from people's consciousness. Certainly it's gone from the consciousness of the media and Facebook and other things that I'm part of, but it exists. It's not gone. The local movement that you and you guys have really pushed is born in that. And so I would just basically say that how can we fill a hole in the soul? Well, probably through relationship with the ground of being or whatever you want to call God, but also the relationships with one another and helping each other. And that's not dead. And that's what we need to keep reminding ourselves and blow into life. I think libertarianism has been co-opted like many things are, but I don't necessarily think that big government is the answer to compassion. So that's my little preaching today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. See, thank you very much. Walter, we've got just a couple minutes left. Any reflections you have about the whole of our being together?
Well, I think is it Bob who was in D.C.? I think the twinning of the cultural and the economic is really important, and I suspect that my comments were tilted toward the economic and away from the cultural, and I appreciate that kind of wake-up call about that.
Great. John, any final thoughts?
It's been a pleasure to be with Walter and to see how much our history still can inform our future. It seems to me that one of the things we need in a good society is to have some roots. And he reminds us of what they are, how deep they are, and their importance as we look ahead to understand where we came from. It's Walter, it's appreciation for that.
Thanks, John.
Yeah. I just want to thank you also, Walter and John, always for kind of deepening and broadening our thinking. I think you're a great prophetic voice yourself for the possibility of the church. And when you call it the church, you're talking about the community as a whole.
Right.
I also
want to
thank Dave and Bob and Joyce for really kind of helping balance our conversation. I really appreciate your calling in and having such a clear and strong voice. And
we
so thank you all for listening. Maggie, let me give it back to you so we can close in a good way.
Okay. Well, I'll add my thanks to you, Walter. It's really, truly always a joy to listen to you, and we appreciate your taking the time to be with us today. And also to thank you to the listeners, the people who were included in the, writing in the chat and those calling in. Lots of people today, and it's always wonderful to see that. And anybody who would like to know more about Walter, he does have a website, and it's walterbrueggemann.com. We hope you'll join us again on our next call, which will be on September 9 with Jackie Reed, and we'll be talking about health as a neighborhood issue. So until then, please visit our website, www.abundantcommunity.com, and stay in touch with us. This brings our program to a close today, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.